It's such an honor, Danny, to be part of this amazing podcast you're doing here. And it's just really cool to be talking about this book.
You know my work and you've given it a lot of thought, and I don't normally get such good questions, to be honest.
Your podcast is the one that I listen to when I want to listen to an interviewer who has A, actually read the book she's asking questions about, and B, asks really interesting, insightful questions about it. And I think that's really special.
Thank you for your wonderful questions.
It was a good chat. Great chat. You're a good interviewer.
It's an absolute pleasure to be interviewed by a very articulate person such as yourself.
I've so enjoyed listening to the podcast. Truly, I love it. And it does just feel like you're having a chat with your mate.
This episode with Trent Dalton chatting about Boy Swallows Universe was released in mid-2018. It is the most listened to episode of all time, and each week remains in the top 5 most listened to episodes to this day. This is a remastered version with a new intro and slightly better sound. It remains one of my favourite interviews because not only is Trent lovely to interview, I just knew there was something very special about his debut novel, Boy Swallows Universe. It was definitely my favourite read for the year of 2018 and remains one of my all-time favourite books alongside Elliot Perlman's Seven Types of Ambiguity, Tim Winton's Cloud Street and Kate Forsyth's Beauty and Thorns. We cover so much ground in this interview, I hope you enjoy. I'm Danny V, your Words and Nerds host.
Thank you so much for your time today, Trent. I'm so excited to talk to you today because I absolutely loved your book, Boy Swallows Universe.
Oh, it's such an honour, Danny. You to be a part of this amazing podcast you're doing here, and it's just really cool to be talking about this book. I'm kind of in the sort of, like, it's just nice now. I'm in a really good period with it, you know. Yeah. I was really nervous at the start of the whole thing with this thing, and now I'm in the best place, and so it's really nice to be talking to you at this time right now.
Excellent. I caught you at a good time. That's great.
Yeah.
Now, the novel is such a powerful book, firstly because of its beautiful prose, and secondly because of the often violent and horrific events that Eli Bell and his family experience. How did you balance the beauty and the horror in this novel?
Oh, great question. Great question. It's something I really... I'm attracted to in storytelling. Mm-hmm. I really do love stories that deal with horror, of the horrors of real life, just straight up, but always in all lives. And this is the thing, I mean, with the people that I kind of grew up with too, they had horrific elements to their lives, and they had, sometimes even some of them had parts of their personalities that weren't the nicest thing ever, but no person is any one thing. No person is all good. No person is all bad. And I didn't want my book to be, I wanted my book to be the same way, you know. I wanted it to be deeply complex and all shades, you know, and because that's a lot like the life that I know. And so I thought, I didn't want it to get sentimental ever or weepy, or I didn't want anyone to feel like it's a sort of a misery memoir. I just wanted people to just take them on a story. And the best way to do that was just to tell everything 100%. And I love sometimes that idea that when people have faced great horror, they're trying to use that great device, that great defense mechanism of light and kind of, the kid in the book, Eli, uses a lot of humor sometimes. And it's a great mechanism in life. But, yeah, but, you know, the suburbs, let's just talk about, you know, I guess the real thing I'm trying to address is the Australian suburbs. And I go for 20 years as a journo, I've been going behind closed doors in those sleepy suburbs, which are across every city in Australia. And there is, as I've seen, as much light as I have seen darkness. And I've seen the most beautiful, selfless events that people have done behind those closed doors, and the darkest, darkest things you wouldn't believe. And I've written about them all. And so I wanted to get that in the first sort of kind of literary fiction book that I wrote.
I love the idea of a book reflecting humanity, that light and dark. That's why it probably resonated with so many people. I mean, I've read the book reviews and it's resonating with everybody.
it's. I tell you, the one thing I really love, and you don't know where that resonance is going to come from. It has been really touching. Someone will go, that part where the kid in the third sort of act of the book, or the second, or that bit at the start, and you're like, oh, wow, that really appealed to you. And I think that the book takes so many cross sections of the Australian kind of life that it has really touched into different sort of sections of Australia, both male and female, and kind of all ages. It's really quite remarkable. My 14-year-old niece read the book and got something really deep out of it, and mm-hmm. and I was really touched by that. And then I spoke to a really conservative woman in Western Australia, battling cancer, like as tough as it can get. And she got something so deep and true out of it. And I just thought that is a real cross section of people, and it's meant the bloody world to me to hear that. And that woman in Perth, in fact, said the most beautiful thing, which I didn't intentionally try and do this, but she said this amazing thing about, she wrote me a letter and she said, I didn't believe people who had done bad things could change, or I didn't believe I could possibly like someone who does such bad things, but you made me change my thinking on that point. And I just thought that was an incredible thing to hear, because it's like she's saying some of these characters, who have many, many flaws, particularly like, the more hardened criminals sides of those characters in that book. She's saying, I understand why this kid likes these people. And I thought, wow, that's kind of me in real life. So you're so right. It's that humanity, I think, that is coming through, which is really lovely. That great thing about it's hard to hate someone up close. And this is someone at a book event told me this. They came up and said, have you heard that saying, it's hard to hate someone when you're up close? And I hadn't really heard it. Maybe I believed in it, but I hadn't heard it crystallized like that. And it's everything the book's about. It's hard to hate someone when you're up close.
Yeah, that's a philosopher said that too. They said there'd be no road rage, there'd be no violence if everyone knew each other, because you just let people pass and you'd let people make mistakes and it'd be okay because you'd know them. So that's a really interesting concept.
Wow.
And I love that Eli is concerned about what makes a good man, because often we try and put people into pockets if you're a good person or you're a bad person. But like you said, it's not true. And these morally ambiguous characters such as Lyle and Alex and Slim convey that people, we are multiple things.
Oh, Danny, absolutely, like Lyle, the character of Lyle, he's from a very real and special place in my heart. Like, I'll tell you my first memory. It's basically I'm sitting in a house in the western suburbs of Brisbane, and my mum had fallen in love with, kind of on paper, the wrong guy, and but she loved him dearly, and I loved that man dearly too. And this guy was, you might call him, a bit of a career criminal, and he was quite a successful 1980s drug dealer, and bizarrely. But my earliest memory is turning around to that man on a brown leather lounge, and I turn to him and I say, "I love you, Dad." And I hadn't met my birth dad at that point, or at least consciously. He'd met me, but I sort of couldn't remember him. And I said to this man, let's call him Lyle. I said, "Lyle, I love you." And he turned to me and he said, "I love you too, mate, but I'm not your dad." And that guy disappeared from my life, and I spent my teenage years growing up with people around suburban kitchen tables saying all sorts of things about this guy.
Mm-hmm.
My old man said wonderful things about him. My mum said wonderful things about him. But on paper, the world would have said that this guy probably wasn't the right guy for me to get lessons from, but he was. He taught me and my brothers all sorts of resilience and strength and love, and he loved us like nobody's business. And that's where that kid Eli Bell is getting all that stuff from, because that's something I did totally growing up as a kid. Is this person a good man? Are you, like, directly looking at people and just I wouldn't ask them sort of directly, but I'd be asking that in my head: is this man a good man? Can I trust this person? And beyond that, then, like, can I love them? Not to sound too psychological or cheesy, but like, I hope this guy is not going to take off or disappear, or can this guy be the stayer and be the sort of father figure that I need? And I suspect maybe Eli Bell's sort of chasing that. He's chasing that person who will stick around and provide all those lessons that he needs, and to the point where he'll find it anywhere he can get it, in the strangest places, like Slim Halliday.
I loved reading about Slim Halliday, and you say in your book, in the acknowledgements, that he was a brief and unique friend from a brief and profound chapter of your childhood, which is, quite incredible. And although...
How did you feel, did you know that when you were reading it and then you read it in the acknowledgements? Like, did you sort of not know anything about Slim and then you read it in the acknowledgements and were like, wow, and like, did that affect your...
I kind of cheated. I didn't know much about him, and then I Googled as I was reading.
Oh, cool. Yeah, that's great. Yeah. I think that probably would enhance it if you Googled him and then found out more as an aside, and then you dive back in and go, hey, you're just picking up on him as he's basically in the Obi-Wan type period of his life.
It was this vortex, though. Once I started reading about him and all the articles, I couldn't stop.
Oh, wonderful. I could write a whole novel, Danny, on just on him. I swear to God. He is an incredibly complex man. And, yeah, I knew him when I was probably about that in that period. So about like when I was about 4 to 8 in the 80s. And by that time, he was just a family friend who sort of would visit this house that my brothers and I were growing up in. And he was just this bloke called Slim. And, you know, this really eccentric guy who wore these, like those black sort of thick black sort of framed glasses. And he slicked his hair back. And he was a really old guy. He's in his 70s by then. But he would let us sort of jump in his car and play around in his car. And he'd tell us stories. And then one day my brothers tell me, like, Trent, you know, Slim, like, I'm the youngest of four boys, and they were like, you know, Slim, he killed a guy. He's like a cold-blooded killer, and he was put away in Queensland's Boggo Road prison for 30 years, and he's known as the Houdini of Boggo Road prison because he escaped the inescapable prison twice in the 1940s, and he's really Machiavellian, intelligent, smart ways that he would create because he had all the time in the world to think about his escapes. And so that guy then becomes, so in my story, so it's all about a kid named Eli Bell who gets compelled to kind of bust into prison on Christmas Day to save his mum's life, the Boggo Road Women's Prison. So who better for the kid to go to for advice than Slim Halliday, you know, like who knows everything there is to know about the about Boggo Road. And so I knew early on when I was even sort of concocting the whole wild ride that Slim had to be that figure, that wisdom figure for the kid. But again, you're jostling with that whole thing. Should a 12-year-old kid be taking any advice from a cold-blooded killer? And that's the question the reader kind of confronts as well, I hope, and sort of goes, you know, is this good for the boy? You know, should I be worried about this boy taking all this kind of stuff from all these people?
And it is interesting because Slim is so full of all this wisdom about time and about love and about escaping, you know, your current situation. And it was interesting because is wisdom valid if it comes from a man who is perceived as evil?
He did one thing. He did two things. He planned his escape, so he read books. And, so, you know, when you've got all the time in the world, you imagine it's a dark cell. I've seen his cell that he was in. It's horrible, Danny. It's like it's as scary and kind of as claustrophobic as you can imagine. So all you've got for 30 years is your head, you know, and he found an amazing ability to do all of that stuff. That's not, you know, I've taken it to new levels because I'm deeply fascinated with time and perspective and the meaning of time and kind of, you know, dare I say the meaning of life, therefore, but it's kind of, all of that stuff is everything Slim was thinking about, like inside. And I finished the book, and it was my mum who kind of said to me, "It's like, how did you sort of capture Slim like that?" And because she knew him better than I did, I just knew him from these vague kind of more feel type memories, if that makes sense. Like I just knew him from an emotional sense as a kid of this wonder that I looked up to him and kind of the things I thought about him as a kid. But then I read a lot about him, but it was my mum who sort of said, "You've captured him, like, so right," because they are the things he would talk about. And he'd talk to my mum and the log character. He talked to them about this sort of stuff, these deep things. He was a deep thinker, and he would dream about space, and he read about the universe and all the things that Eli Bell is fixated by as well. That all comes from Slim, and it's sort of, he's filling the kid's mind with all of this amazing stuff about time and how you can slow it down and speed it up through the bad times, slow it down through the good times. And that's a notion that I love. You know, it's like something we all try and do as humans, even if we don't know it. And, I've been getting messages from people who are in really dark times, dead set, and they're saying to me, you know, I'm trying to speed up time right now. And then as soon as I'm done with this, I'll be slowing it down. And you just go, that's an incredibly beautiful thing to say. And yeah, so it all becomes this really inspiring thing. And that's what I love about the book is that, well, that's why, anyway, like I wanted to write this work of fiction anyway, because I did want to talk about deeper and bigger universal kind of things that take, you know, that can be seen through a kid's eyes, sort of in a naive kind of way. But just tap into these really grand kind of things like time and existence.
I loved the ideas of time in the novel, and I love Eli. He makes a really good point. He says, "The universe didn't put the numbers on our calendars. If we didn't put those numbers on the clock, then Caitlin's spies wouldn't age." And I thought, how intriguing is that? Because we have obsession with age and aging, and wouldn't life just be less complicated if that wasn't around?
Oh man, that's amazing, Danny. Yeah, that's so cool. You know that. Like, that all comes from, like, I met my wife when I was 20, right? And like, my wife's basically Caitlin Spies, like, super, whatever.
I wondered, know, secretly.
Yeah. Well, you know, the kid basically marries. Anyway, oh, I won't spoil it for people. Oh, no, did I just give a spoiler?
I can cut it out if you like.
No, that's fine. But, like, basically she was, and she was 28 at the time, right? Mm. And so my wife and I always laugh about this thing that, imagine if I met her when I was like 8 and she would have been like, you know, whatever, 16 or something.
Yeah.
That would just be so weird, you know, for me to fall in love with that girl, you know what I mean? But like, what is time and what is, you know, I mean, that, you know, that, and I was playing on that. It's like, it's sort of like, that would scare the hell out of me. If we got our timing, already our timing was off in a sense, you know, like on an age sense, we're not quite, you know, now we've both grown old together, sort of, you know, age starts to matter less. Isn't that funny? Like, as you grow older, but it's sort of like, but that's where all that stuff comes from. The kid's constantly going, like, I've got my timing wrong with this girl that I love. I'm in love with her, but she'll never give me the time of day because I'm still young. And I wanted to write something that had that really long time arc where you're sort of almost in that Dickensian way, you know, that you can do something young and then the payoffs will come, you know, when you're older. And I love that in storytelling. I love that in, you know, the great thick books of the world where you've got the time to really have your payoffs happen, you know, on the last page of the book, something that happens in the first 15. And I think that's really special. And I've always liked that. And that whole device of time then really started to come into it. And you're right. I do think we're totally fixated with time and age and, you know, and particularly time skipping by. You know, I wonder, you know, that's that thing. Yeah. If there was no time on the calendar, then Caitlin Spies would just be Caitlin Spies.
Yeah.
She wouldn't be defined by anything else but just the special girl that she is.
I think as well, I think we're about the same vintage, but, you know, even as a person aging, I don't know if it's different for men, but a woman aging, I feel like you can't become defined by kind of what decade you're in.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Let's just get rid of that calendar. I'm totally cool with that.
Down with it, man. You're down with it, yeah.
Totally.
No, I totally agree, and I do find that absolutely ridiculous. Like, it's like my favourite actresses are, you know, like Jodie Foster, right? Mm-hmm. Or like, you know, and I just go, and I just never see her in enough movies. And, you know, I like all these actresses who I loved in the 90s who were just killing it. And then suddenly I have to watch them, like, just suffer these kind of, I don't know, these roles that aren't doing these geniuses justice. Mm. And it's like, it's that age thing that's sort of doing it. It's those numbers on the calendar. And yeah, but yeah, you're so right. It's a real thing. And I don't know whether men, you know, have suffered the same fate as that or endure that as much as women, yeah.
It's like a fight to become more than a mother. Like, I'm not saying just a mother because being a mother is an amazing thing, but it's that fight to show, hey, I'm also all these other things too.
Oh, wow. Well, and I'm not the right guy to comment, but I've noticed that, for example, in my wife's life, I'll tell it from that perspective. That's right. It's like her life, we talk about it all the time. It gets broken down into chunks. It's like, okay, you're a mum now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now you're the working mum for a bit now. And then, you know, I think whereas I've been fortunate enough to have this kind of career where I did all these things and I was like, became a dad, but I've still been the journo. You know, I've always been defined as a journalist. You know, no one often sort of says father of two, you know what I mean? Whereas she sometimes gets referred to as mother of two, you know, and it's sort of like, yeah, it's sort of, I've done it myself. I've done it myself in stories where I go, you know, mother of two, Tracy such and such. And I'm like, oh, man, she's so much more than that. You know, she's, so, you know, it's like this person that I'm talking about. So I'm really conscious of that very thing you're talking about, these pigeonholes and these blocks. It's like we break a woman's life down into blocks. And it's not right. Yeah, that's just sort of wrong, isn't it? It's sort of like, yeah. But I know it's, you know, we do that because we need these in storytelling even, which is like journalism is just storytelling. We need those blocks, these categories to quickly define someone. And I know, I'm working on it.
Well, these conversations are good, you know, because people are talking about it, so it's good.
for sure, absolutely.
Something else I found so intriguing came from, it's Bitch Dang, right? That's how I say
it. Yeah. I love Bitch Dan.
Me too, right? Scary. I don't think I'd want to meet her in real life. Terrifying.
No.
But she states, and I love this, and I never thought about it before, but when I read it, I'm like, oh, I think this is true. She says, the greatest secret about Australia is the nation's inherent misery. Australian childhoods are so idyllic that Australian adulthoods can't possibly meet our childhood expectations. And I was like, oh my God, is that why adults are so miserable?
Oh, it's funny when you write a big sweeping statement like that, in a book, and it's clearly coming from the writer's mind, but you're putting in the mouth of this woman named Bitch Dan, who's like, who almost can get away with, like, she's so much ballsier than I am. Yeah. She's got so much more courage than I have, you know. So she's saying these things that are really sort of these cutting kind of insights into the Australia that she has observed in the 1980s. And, yeah, it's definitely things that cross my mind. You know, I do feel... I don't know what it is. I do feel sometimes there's an innocence and a purity that we lose as Australian adults, you know, that we all had as kids. Like, do you remember the 1980s as a kid in Australia? It's absolutely freaking glorious.
Yes.
It was just like, do you remember?
I do.
Just remember it as like...
Free. You were free.
It's just so amazing, isn't it? You know, like, and then the 90s were just as wonderful, and it was just sort of like... These are good times, and then just the real world kicks in and you realise that this country and all of its bounty of sunshine and everything has a sort of a complexity that you suddenly realise as an adult, and that's just sort of natural. I'm sure that happens for every adult in the world, but it's like in Australia it's a strange thing because you are just this billabong kid, you know. I mean that in the sense of the billabong pond, but also the billabong ice cream, you know. It's like... You were just this kid just getting around, sucking on, you know, the ice cream truck comes past and you're playing street cricket. You're doing a bit of maths homework. You're riding on the skateboard. You're going down to play, you know, Space Invaders. And then suddenly, you know, I don't know. And even you know, then you turn 16 and then you just, I don't know, you're drinking some Lagoon and you're going down the pier and you're fishing. It doesn't get bad until ever. But, you know, yeah, and that's what she's sort of saying. And you're right, I do note that kind of just this inherent kind of like, that comes with adulthood. But that said, it's so funny. So many people read that and they go, I don't know. I love my life as an adult. It's sort of quite funny to hear people react to that line. And, you know, I don't necessarily agree that, you know, that's 100% correct. But it's certainly a thing that I've seen that put it this way. I have a lot of like... You know, a lot of blokey conversations, right? With a lot of blokes talking about their glory days, and that might be the first 15, whatever, you know. And then you're just going, "Oh man!" Like, and I often sometimes get a little bit saddened by that. I sort of go, "You'd hope that your life is on a kind of upward kind of roller coaster, right? It's heading upwards to the slope that fine, you know, and you're not even going to go down that slope until you're 90 or something, you know. Like, it's like you'd hope your life was just going up and up and up and up. But so often, and I find a lot of men that I speak to, you know, that's not the case. You know, they have these sort of, I don't know, these quiet miseries that you might call these quiet miseries that you see. I'm not saying every bloke or anything, but I don't know whether it's our wonderful childhoods that have sort of set us up for that. But it's an interesting thought. It's an interesting thing about that idea of this amazing world that we have as kids and these opportunities. And it can only go down from there. You know what I mean? It's that brilliant that it can only go down, mate. I don't know. Do you reckon?
Yeah, you know what? I also think it's an 80s thing because being an 80s child, like, there was no other great time to grow up. Like, you had such freedom and there's not that kind of freedom. You know, I don't give my kids that kind of freedom that I had, you know. But there was just this fantastic... I kind of feel sorry for people who didn't grow up in the 80s because it was just this different time, you know, that kids don't experience now.
Well, it's the world Eli Bell's experiencing too. He's clearly a kid who can come home at when the sun goes down. You know what I mean? Like, whereas I've got two girls, 11 and 9. I did it for the first time. I said, "Yeah, you can go for a ride." And dead set, Danny, it was like 100 meters down the street, and the sun started going down, right? And I got in my car, and I'm like this terrified parent going down to the basketball court, and I'm like looking at them and making sure they're okay. And you know, my old man would let it go for like 2 hours into darkness before he'd really start getting worried. And, you know, and then I'd come home and be like, "Where the bloody hell were you?" And I'd explain, and then he'd go, "All right, just get home before 6, will you, next time," or whatever. You know, you're just like, and you've been riding, you know, 10, 20Ks across Southeast Queensland, you know, and it's just like, just madness. Like, just that just never happens now. And that was the 80s, hey? I don't know.
But how did 80s people like us then become helicopter parents? Like, I don't understand that.
Oh, why did that happen? I know. How the hell did that happen? I know. We become the helicopter parents. That's so true.
We're funny.
The most protective of the lot. And now it's our parents, the baby boomers, who are going at us like, oh, you're being way too overprotective. They look at us like we're just these, you know, robots who just can't relax.
Oh, it's funny, man. Yesterday I took my kids roller skating because my dad used to take me roller skating all the time, and I would never thought of wearing a helmet, no protection, no, just chuck my skates on and go. I took my kids, and seriously, wrist guards, knee pads, helmet, and I was like, what's happening?
Funny. That is so funny. I took my girls for a bike ride. Yeah, I know. And it's like, helmet, strap that, tight, put that right up on their chin, you know, tie that thing right up. You know, it's like, we didn't even have the stack hat, like, introduced because, you know, we were just all cracking our heads open, and finally they just went, all right, mate,
that's
enough. Give those kids something to wear.
Our kids are going to live forever.
They will. That's funny. Love it. Now, that's what I loved doing in the book, though. I loved all that. Like, they were the best parts. Like, all the reminiscing and all the nostalgia. Like, the book's just riddled with it, you know. It's riddled with, like, Pacito soft drink and
different
all this
strokes.
Stuff. Like, different strokes. Absolutely. Romper Room, Golden Gay Times.
Family Ties.
Don't even get me started on Family Ties. It's, like, still my favourite show of all time.
Did you wish he was your dad in real life?
Yeah, totally. Like, it's, like, the story of my life, just looking at this dad who's, like, pouring his kid orange juice and just dreaming, like, wow, imagine having a dad like that who just sits and pours you orange juice and listens to your problems.
Are you that dad now, the orange juice pouring dad, listening over the kitchen bed?
Oh, wow, that's a really good question. Like, you know, My problem is I've got all the love of Stephen Keaton, but not all the time. That's the problem. Stephen Keaton seemed to have all the time in the world. He just didn't even ever work, that guy. He just sat in the kitchen talking to his kids. But it was like, so I've got all of the love and care, I swear to God, Danny, but I just don't have the time, so I can't quite, you know, I'm not there just like, you know, just listening to every word. I'm trying real hard to get to my inner Stephen Keaton.
Well, he's a fictional character who didn't, you know, have to actually go to work. So I don't think we should feel too bad about ourselves.
True. Hey, that's the thing. You can't model yourself on these people. They are fictional works from a team of writers based in Los Angeles. They are not real dads. That's so funny.
Now, August Bell, I want to talk about August Bell. I loved him. He was beautiful and a wondrous character.
Thank you,
so unique and insightful. And I just loved the way he was writing the words in the air. Now, I read somewhere that he was kind of a culmination of your three brothers. How else did August emerge? He was a beautiful character.
Yeah, thank you. Like, seriously, like, you say that, Danny, like, you're paying compliment to the people I love most in my life, you know, and, like, and you pay any compliment of these characters because you're talking about the people I love dearly, and it's basically my brothers, my mum and dad. They're the people who saved me. They're the people I owe every last thing, you know, to in my life, and an extreme amount I owe for their just being so brilliant about this whole book, for one thing. But to answer your question, August is really from complete. He is completely an amalgam of my three brothers. So there's Jesse, who is this wondrous kid who I've sort of described as basically Oscar Wilde growing up in Housing Commission Brisbane, and then there's Ben, who is Obi-Wan Kenobi, and then there's Joel, who's basically King Arthur and the protector and the guy who kind of defend us and still sort of does, really, in many ways. And that element, though, that wondrous kind of element of August like that, this writing in the air, that's straight from my brother Jesse, who would do that. He did that as a kid. He'd write these stories in the air like that, and I'd catch him, you know, writing with his right forefinger out, and he'd dip his finger into his tongue like it was an inkwell, and then he'd write some more, and then he'd sort of hit full stop, like he'd hit a full stop in the air. And I'm like, what are you writing? And, you know, I couldn't read it the way, you know, I could read some of it, but I couldn't read it the way Eli can in the book. And it's me just taking this wondrous, beautiful guy, Jesse, that element of him, and putting that, and paying tribute to that, because that sparks me as a kid. I'm looking at that and going, God, man, you're a wondrous human being. And as I did with all my bros, you know, like they're really special people, Danny. Like I wish you could sit here and talk to them. They're far more interesting than me, you know. And it's like they're really interesting dudes. I wanted to just sort of pay tribute and get across to the world the love I have for those boys. And if I could get that across, I reckon people will be really interested in that book, because I've never been able to capture to people like, oh, you know, people can tell who know us four boys. They know that we love each other dearly. But I've never been able to express it properly in words, and I needed 470 pages to. And it's like, you know, that brotherly love or that sibling solidarity, you know. And it's, I love it when I had a tweet from someone who said she grew up on a farm with her sister, and she said that reminded me of the love I have for my sister. And I thought, man, that is so beautiful. If people across Australia, all of us who have siblings, you know, just going, wow, you know, that's that relationship. Who doesn't remember? You know, everyone remembers that. You know, you're growing up in some room and you're just dreaming and talking with your brother or sister, and you're just thinking about your future, and but you're lost in this special world for a time. And those beautiful dark, you know, when the lights go out, it's just you and your sibling, and you're just talking stuff and you're dreaming, and that's so special. That you know, the Finn Brothers wrote a great song about that. It's called Disembodied Voices, and it's very powerful. And it's like, it's all about these voices just going up in the air, and the Finn Brothers used to sort of always kind of dream like that, and the Dalton boys were doing that as well, as the Bell Brothers would in the book, you know. It's very powerful.
And in a way, they know parts of you that no one else can know, can they? Because that growing up part is just such an important part that helps you define who you become.
Oh, man, that's very well said. That's very insightful, Danny. And no one's sort of brought that up, actually. Like, that my brothers do know elements of me nobody, you know, ever can, you know, because you had to be there and you had to be in those rooms when the lights went out, and you had to sort of, well, you know, and yeah, you had to sort of endure some of the crap, you know, and, you know, and it's like, or a lot of the crap, and you sort of, you do that together and you come out the other side, you know, and you were just like, I don't know, you feel like some sort of platoon coming back from some crazy sort of dream war that you don't even remember happened, you know, but you've got these shared experiences, and we're still talking about moments that come up, and we'll just go, remember that? Remember that? Yeah, that's right. It's just this ongoing kind of fascinating thing. It was so beautiful to see them read this book and kind of find things in it and go and remember things. But, you know, the most beautiful thing is their reaction to it, in the sense of, like, they say to me, it's really interesting that you saw it through those eyes and you saw it that way, because their version of the events would be completely different, and they would be coloured by their eyes, and I'm sure it'd be so amazing and fascinating, but it'd be just different. And I love that there were four boys involved, and they all saw these stories unfolding in different ways. And, you know, this Boy Swallows Universe is just my particular story of those events.
Something else I loved in the novel was the kind of mystical red telephone. And it conjured up a few things for me. The first one was possibly the power of a child's imagination. But the second thing for me, it was really reminiscent of Tim Winton's Talking Pig in Cloud Street. It's present without explanation of how it fits into reality. It just is what it is. How did you fit this into your story?
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah. Look, it's amazing how much sort of DNA of Cloud Street is kind of in there. Uh-huh. Like, I love that book so
me
much.
Too.
You know, but I read it a long time ago, so I don't know how much its impact on me is probably bigger than I even know, you know. But it was one of those books where I read and I was like, God damn, I love reading these books where it's like, this is my family, and it's like, or I just see how fun, it's so relatable, and it really did. And also the wonder that you put in that, That red telephone comes from a very real place. Like that was a real thing, like in real life. Like that, you know, one of my most vivid memories from that time was my brothers and I creeping in to a secret, basically, this guy, let's call him Lyle, the guy my mum loved, he had basically a secret room built in that extended from a sliding wardrobe that was in his room. My brother could push a sort of compression mechanism at the back of this room, this wardrobe, and wood panel fell out, and my brother slipped into this room, and my next, like, the younger boys out of the four, we watched my brother slide into this room, and there was nothing in this sort of, it's basically a safe room or escape room, really, made out of bricks built into the earth, and there was nothing in that room but a red telephone. Now, that always blew my mind as a kid, you know, as it would, like any boy, you're just going, I mean, it's a great day when you find a room like that, but But that always just made me thrilled in terms of it popped things open in my imagination. I think that I have always remained open for the rest of my life. I'd be sitting in maths class later when we get dragged over to North Side Brisbane. I'm just thinking about that room, right? I'm just like, you know, who was on the end of that red telephone? What was it for? And if you don't have all the answers, like, you're going to get told, you know, my old man told me, I'll tell you when you grow up, Trent, but he never told me, you know, and I didn't get all the answers, and sadly he died, and there were things that he knew that I never got to hear, but, you know, sometimes you write the answers yourself, and that's what I did almost. I was just going, look, that is a wondrous thing, and what if that red telephone was the boy's kind of, it was a dangerous thing, but also it could be a saving thing, and you know, and you got it in one day. It is about, you know, the things a child's imagination will do through trauma, but also there is that talking pig kind of thing. That's really interesting, right? It's that sort of device really as well. It became a narrative device, mm-hmm. as well, a very powerful narrative device, and you know, and I love that you might not find out about what, you know, who is on the end of that red telephone until the last page of the book, really. And that's really cool. That always really inspired me as just even just writing it physically, right? Like actually the writing of it, sort of me dancing with that, you know, all through it. It was a very tingling kind of really powerful thing, and it really drove a lot of the momentum of the writing of it. And so it was a really fun thing. It also speaks to elements in storytelling that I have just always loved. I love noir kind of surreal kind of mixes of type movies. Like I love Terry Gilliam type things, like films like Brazil and mm-hmm. 12 Monkeys and things like that, where things happen and you don't know whether it is truth or lies, or whether it's fact or fiction, or whether it's science fiction or what's going on. And I love that element but everything I did in this book, I still wanted to make sure I had some justification, because there were wild things I was dreaming up, I tell you, that I just left out because I wanted everything to have a justification in the real world, you know what I mean? Like, so it was sort of like all these amazing things, but, you know, sometimes I love David Lynch, but I get really frustrated with him when I love Mulholland Drive, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Love it, but I just would love it so much more if it made... if it just had a bit more sense in the real world, like if it just worked a little bit harder. But then I watch it again, I go, no, but I find my own answers, and yeah. So that's still genius, you know. But anyway, so yeah, it's sort of all that. It's all a mix of all that. It's very Lynchian as well, and it's kind of, William Burroughs kind of stuff as well in there, and all sorts of really cool stuff that I really was drawing on with that room that speaks to a lot of that great storytelling stuff where it's a message from a mysterious place, and you've got to, are you going to seize the moment? And, you know, I love that message comes through that the kid goes on, that Eli goes on his great adventure in the first place.
And you're really interested in the child brain and the way it processes trauma, and you mentioned that before. And through this writing process, what have you learned about this, and has it resonated with you and your own experiences?
It's been really amazing. It's been really... quite bizarre. Like, the really funny thing is when you go do the sort of promo type stuff, and you sit in these rooms, and you're talking to like crowds of like 100 or whatever, and you're talking really, you know, stuff that is sacred to you, like these sort of mythologies that you've built up within yourself, but they're actually your own personal kind of story. And then people sort of, they go through this cathartic process with you, even in the reading of it, and then the listening to the talks and stuff, and you come out of it and you're going like, what have I learned from that? And you just learn this deeper humanity for one thing. But I did learn that, you know, I do think, I finished the book and I said to my wife, like, what have I done? Like, why did I do this? You know, and then I, you know, I finish and then I send it to my mum and I say, why did I do it? And she goes, Trent, I know, of course I know why you did it. And she's so supportive and amazing and unbelievable, just like as she is kind of the character that she's based on in the book, you know, that sort of, it's like the, you know, she's like, well, look, you had some stuff, you know, and you wrote through it because that's what you've been doing for 20 years. That's what I do. And I sort of, as a journalist, I've been doing that. I go in the living rooms and I seek out these stories that are, you know, really sort of incredibly intense. And you sort of, but you're in there with these Australians who are just telling you their life stories and every secret they have to give you. And you're processing it with them. And then you're taking that and it's helping you heal whatever baggage you've got in your own heart and mind, and that's sort of this really strange kind of shared process. I just did it. I did that in turned it into 470 pages, and it was sort of, and then in the end, you've got these. Now my brother Ben says it like really beautifully. You carry these rocks with you, you know, these rocks that you just keep carrying and carrying for years and years, and it's like, why do you carry them? Why am I still carrying them? And you know, well, okay, why don't I just throw them into sort of a big molten lava kind of thing called a book and just sort of turn it into something beautiful, you know? And I thought maybe I'll give that a shot. And then, and I tell you that the process part of it that is beautiful is that people read it and get something out of it. And then they go, oh, that's very reflective of my life. And that's something closer towards like just some actual, like you're turning those rocks and making them useful. And that's really cool. Like that is so great. That is such an amazing process. I know it sounds so cheesy, but
no, I love that image.
Yeah, like I just didn't expect that. I genuinely didn't expect that. I hadn't counted on that. I didn't expect it, and it's just been really beautiful. That it's just been such a wonderful, unexpected sort of element to it.
And because so much came from your childhood, what was the writing process?
It was pretty I'd finish work, and I'd my wife and I would have dinner, and then I'd go downstairs into this little sort of, you know, kind of rumpus room type thing we've got, and I'd write from 8 till 10. And the good thing about writing through the eyes of a 12-year-old boy named Eli Bell is that it wasn't a 39-year-old journalist named Trent Dalton, and so that kid can say things that I probably wouldn't even be ready to face. Even, like, I know that sounds sort of like it's like there were things that I was and to the point where I even sort of shied away from them, even through that kid's eyes, you know what I mean? So let alone myself. And I think I just think if I wrote some sort of misery memoir or whatever, I don't think I would have confronted things, or I think it wouldn't have been as true in many ways. You know what I mean? Does that make sense? Even though it was a memoir, it wouldn't be as true or something, if that's possible. But the beauty of writing through this kid, Eli Bell, who I've just come to love, you know, like he's like this sort of, he is an amalgam again of all my brothers and myself, and he's a lot of me, but he's sort of this great version of me, of a kid I wish I was, you know. And he's got more courage, he's got more insight, more wisdom, and he's just got more sass, you know, and all these great sort of parts about the kid, so he can get away with confronting these things. He's got the strength to confront these things and write about them in his special voice that I probably couldn't have as a 39-year-old journalist, you know. And there were chapters that I wrote, and one chapter in particular, and probably the only chapter that got rewritten heavily by, you know, the HarperCollins editor, this amazing woman, Catherine Milne, who just said, look, Trent, you're not facing that particular part. And I wasn't. I'd written it in this weird sort of past tense, almost as a letter, and it got away from the actual sort of feel and flow of the actual story that the rest of the story was written in. And it was genuinely because I wasn't sort of being man enough to kind of confront it and be in the moment like I should have, because the moment was drawn from a very real and very harrowing moment in my life. And, several. I mean, there were just endless moments like that. And, and relating to harm being done to the woman I loved most in all of my life, being my mum. And so then you sort of, yeah, so it's sort of like, you know, very real, raw type stuff. So in the writing, it was really strange. So you're down in your little rumpus room, and, you know, you put your, you know, you start to, like, at, you know, you finish, you're 10 p.m. at night on a Wednesday night in sleepy Brisbane, and you're going through these kind of strange things in print, and you're kind of like, as you're writing them, and then you just put the computer down, and then you go up and read your book and go to bed, but you've just processed the most intense stuff from your life. So it's strange old process, but it powered some things, though, let me tell you. Like, it was an electrically sort of powered kind of book in that way. Like, it was just like, okay, I've only got 2 hours, I'm just gonna burn this out. I am just gonna like write it out. And that's why the book has a bit of, it reads pretty urgent. Like, it's got some urgency in the prose has some urgency, and I think it's because I didn't labor on words. I just didn't, because I know Eli Bell wouldn't have, you know what I mean? And that's why it sort of reads with a bit of speed and urgency. So, yeah, and I sort of like that, because I would have laboured on it as a 39-year-old journalist.
And so after such a difficult and cathartic experience of writing the book, what's next? You're taking a break, having a rest, or you're just going to go straight back into another novel?
It's so funny, yeah. Like, I am kind of really in that wonderful phase of actually, yeah, like, really dreaming up the story of the next one. And it's really cool. It's been really wonderful to kind of just dive back into just this story. There were so many other things I wanted to write before I wrote this. But then I just started, the more I thought about it, this is the one I've got to write. You know, if there's one story I had to write in my life, Danny, it was that one. Like, mm-hmm. I swear to God, it's Boy Swallows Universe. That's the story I wanted to write most. And I'm so glad it sort of, like, it's got to sort of come out even sort of maybe better than I even first thought it would. And, you know, so I'm just so proud that that's just done. And, like, I was so proud the moment I hit full stop on it. I swear to God, it would have been just great. And all this other brilliant stuff has just been so wonderful. But the other, yeah, the flip side of that is just to go, look, now the world is just open. You know, there is a green pasture that I can just go freaking run wild in that I'm really excited about. And there's... I'm currently, yeah, basically thinking about four different stories that I really want to write. I want to write them all. And one's about coincidence, one's about lies, one's about two beautiful girls. Like, this one's about two beautiful boys. This next one, you know, I really want to write a story about girls and sort of mums. And then there's another one I want to write about ghosts. And then there's this other one I want to write about, actually, about... just sort of basically the concept of love, like it being just a beautiful concept that if you're from another place, you'd be quite blown away by. But anyway, that's I'm probably, yeah. And you know, the thing I mean now is like which one of those is going to speak to me the most.
Well, it sounds like you need to do some slowing down of time so you can write them all.
Oh, well said. I love it, Danny. I love it. I love it, man. I love that. Yeah, just slow it down. Just sit and write them all. I love that. That's brilliant. You're a legend. That's beautiful.
Well, thank you so much, Trent, for taking us on such a deep exploration of this beautiful novel, Boy Swallows Universe. And I absolutely am completely honest when I say it's now one of my favourite novels, right up there with Cloud Street.
So oh, wow. Wow. Thank you, Danny.
It's been such a pleasure.
What an honour talking to you. Seriously, great podcast and great chat. Seriously, thanks for all your beautiful insights. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Trent.